Hello, my friend. Come in. Come sit. I've been waiting for you. Last time, we sat with Elia Levita, a man who spent his whole life carrying grammar, actual grammar, the bones of a language, across borders that didn't want him there. Quietly. Stubbornly. Page by page. I loved that story. I think you did, too. Today, I want to tell you about someone who carried something even harder to hold on to than grammar. He carried it in his mind, because for a long time, it was the only thing he had left that no one could take from him. He didn't set out to be remembered. He didn't even set out for the place this story happens. He was going somewhere else entirely, on a ship with his teacher, expecting an education, not a destiny. Let's find out what happened when the sea had other plans. Picture the ship, salt-heavy air, the creak of timber, the slap of water against the hull. Somewhere on the Red Sea, a Phoenician vessel out of Tyre has put in at harbor to take on water and trade goods before pressing on toward India. Aboard her, a philosopher named Meropius, bound for the wider world the way scholars sometimes are, restless, curious, unwilling to let his education stop at the edge of a map. And with him, two young men near the end of their own schooling, Frumentius, his brother, Odysseus, not children. Young men on the cusp of finishing what years of tutors and texts had been building toward, Greek, rhetoric, the careful arithmetic of trade, almost ready to go be someone, somewhere. They never got that far. I watched it happen the way I watch so much, close enough to feel it, powerless to stop it. The harbor should have been safe. It wasn't. Local raiders came down on the ship without warning, and by the time the water went still again, the crew was gone. Meropius was gone. The whole voyage, gone in the time it takes a wave to break, except for two young men, spared. No one told them why. I still don't fully understand that mercy. Maybe it wasn't mercy at all. Maybe it was something colder. A calculation! A glance that noticed these two were worth more alive than dead. Whatever it was, it dragged Frumentius and his brother inland, in chains, toward a kingdom neither of them had ever meant to see. He thought his education was finished. It was about to matter more than he ever imagined. Let me take you back to Tyre, because you can't understand what happened next without understanding what Frumentius already was before the raiders ever found that ship. Tyre was not a sleepy little port. It was one of the great trading cities of the Phoenician world, its ships running the length of the Mediterranean and beyond, its merchants fluent in the languages of everyone they did business with. And in a city like that, education wasn't a luxury reserved for the idle. It was a tool. A merchant family that wanted its sons to matter, to negotiate, to keep accounts, to represent the family's name in rooms far from home, invested in their minds the way they invested in ships and cargo. So Frumentius and Odysseus were given a classical education, Greek, first and always, the working language of trade across the whole Eastern Mediterranean and down into the Red Sea. Rhetoric, so a young man could speak persuasively in front of strangers. Numeracy sharp enough to manage a ledger, because a merchant's word was only as good as his math. This was not schoolroom trivia. This was the making of a young man useful anywhere he landed. Their teacher, the philosopher Meropius, wasn't a casual traveling companion. I want to be honest with you about that, because it changes the shape of the story. Later tellings soften him into an uncle, someone along for the ride. But the truth, I think, is plainer and more interesting. He was their tutor. Their voyage wasn't a family outing. It was the last leg of an education, a philosopher taking his students out past the edge of the world they already knew, the way a teacher sometimes does when the lesson can't be finished inside four walls. Which means when the ship went down, it didn't just take a crew and a scholar. It took the very structure that had been shaping two young men for years. What was left was only what they'd already absorbed, whatever they'd truly learned, not just heard. Now, let me tell you about the kingdom that found them. Aksum in those years was not some remote, disconnected backwater waiting to be discovered by the wider world. It was a genuine power, a trading kingdom stretching across the Red Sea coast and into the highlands, wealthy enough to mint its own coinage, ambitious enough to stamp that coinage in Greek, because Greek was the language of the merchants Axum wanted to impress and do business with. This was a court that looked outward. A king who understood that literate men who could read contracts, write letters, and speak the language of Roman and Byzantine trade were not a curiosity. They were an asset. So when two shipwrecked young men were dragged before the Axumite king, beaten, grieving, utterly at the mercy of a stranger, what happened next wasn't inevitable. It could have gone the way captivity so often went in the ancient world. Hard labor, obscurity, a life spent invisible. It didn't. Because somewhere in that first meeting, the king saw past what these two young men currently were, captives, foreigners, nothing, to what they had already been trained to become. And he made a choice that would outlast him by a great deal more than he could have known. He kept them close. He put their minds to work. I want you to sit with that for a moment, because I think we tell this story too fast if we don't. The word history uses is slave. And it isn't wrong. Frumentius was unfree, under another man's authority, with no power to walk away. But I've watched slavery take 1,000 different shapes across 1,000 different centuries, and this was never going to be the version with a whip and a quarry. This was a king recognizing that a captive's mind might be worth more than a captive's labor, and choosing, quite deliberately, to use it that way. Before I continue, a word from our sponsor. Friends, let me ask you something. You're a Phoenician merchant. You've got cargo. You've got crew. You've got a philosopher and two promising young students aboard for the educational voyage of a lifetime. What could possibly go wrong? Everything. Everything could go wrong. And that's where we come in. I'm talking about Adulis Assurance Co., Red Sea Passage Insurance, serving discerning travelers of the Erythraean trade routes since we started noticing how often ships don't come back. For a modest premium, paid in silver, grain, or a reasonable quantity of frankincense, Adulis Assurance guarantees, if pirates take your cargo, we mourn with you. If pirates take your ship, we mourn with you. And if pirates take you personally and sell you into the service of a foreign king, well, we can't get you back. Nobody can get you back. But we can make sure your family entire receives full and prompt compensation in a timely fashion by the next caravan, assuming the caravan also survives. Some captives, we're told, go on to tutor princes and found entire churches. Adulis Assurance does not cover that outcome either. Frankly, we don't know how to price it. Adulis Assurance Co., murky waters, protected margins. Terms and conditions apply. Terms and conditions cannot actually help you once you're at sea. So the king made his decision, and Frumentius found himself with a title he never could have predicted for himself. Secretary. Treasurer. The trusted hand behind a throne that wasn't his own. Odysseus became a cupbearer, close enough to the king's daily life to matter. Trusted with what a king eats and drinks. No small thing in a court where poison was always a possibility worth guarding against. I watched Frumentius in those years, and here is what struck me. He didn't perform gratitude. He didn't perform anything. He simply did the work in front of him, carefully, competently, the way anyone does when they've decided quietly to make themselves indispensable rather than merely tolerated. Every ledger balanced, every letter drafted with the same care he'd have given it back entire for a family that was no longer his to serve. Years passed that way. I won't pretend I remember every one of them in detail. Even a goddess's memory softens at the edges when nothing dramatic happens for a long while, and most of those years were simply this. Two young men far from home making themselves useful, one ordinary day at a time. Then the king grew ill. And here is where the story could have ended, the way so many stories like it end. A captive freed, sent on his way, vanishing from the record entirely once he was no longer needed. The king, dying, did free them. He gave them exactly what any captive dreams of, the right to leave. They didn't leave. The queen, newly widowed, suddenly responsible for a kingdom and a child too young to rule it, came to them with a request instead of an order. Stay. Help me raise my son. Help me hold this kingdom together until he's old enough to hold it himself. I think about that moment more than almost anything else in this story. Frumentius owed her nothing. He'd been taken by force, put to work by circumstance, and now, finally, freedom was sitting right in his open hand, and he closed his hand around something else instead. So began the part of this story that never gets a monument. There was no ordination for this, no title, just a young man sitting with a child day after day, teaching him letters, teaching him language, teaching him how a kingdom is actually run instead of merely inherited. I don't know exactly what Frumentius taught young Azana in those years. Nobody wrote it down. Nobody thought to. But I was there in the room more times than you'd guess, and I can tell you this. It was not casual. It was not an afterthought squeezed between more important duties. It was the work. Years of it. A prince becoming a young man, shaped daily by a tutor who had once been shaped the very same way, in a different city, by a very different teacher. Before the sea took that teacher away. When Azana finally came of age, old enough to rule without a regent, old enough to release the two men who'd raised him in his father's place, Odysseus made his choice. He went home, back to Tyre, back to the city he'd been stolen from, where he was ordained a priest and, as far as I know, lived out a quieter life than his brothers. Frumentius chose differently. He didn't go home. He went to Alexandria instead, close enough to Tyre to smell it, and turned the other way entirely. He went to ask Athanasius, the bishop there, to send a proper bishop and priest south to formalize what he'd only been able to build informally, a church for the Christians already quietly worshiping in Axum, a structure that could outlast one tutor's influence over one former student. And Athanasius looked at the man standing in front of him, a former captive, a self-taught missionary, a tutor with no formal theological training at all, and made a decision of his own. You're the one I'm sending back. So Frumentius went back, not as a tutor this time, not as a secretary with no real standing of his own, but as a bishop. Ordained by Athanasius himself, sent south with the full weight of the church in Alexandria behind him, he returned to Axum and did something he'd never been able to do in all his years at that court. He built it properly. An episcopal see at Axum, a structure, a church that didn't depend on one man's presence in one room to survive. And then he did the thing this whole story had been quietly building toward all along. He baptized Azana. Try to picture what that meant to the people watching. Not just a king adopting a foreign religion. Kings do that sometimes for politics, for alliance, for reasons that have nothing to do with belief. This was different, and everyone close to the court would have known it was different. This was a king being baptized by the very man who'd raised him. The tutor's lessons, made visible, made public, made permanent in front of the whole kingdom. Azana didn't stop there. He built churches. He let the faith he'd been taught as a boy become the faith of a nation. Not overnight, not by decree alone, but steadily, the way anything takes root when it's planted early and tended long. Axumite coinage, which had carried old symbols for generations, began to carry the cross instead. Public inscriptions changed. A kingdom that had once been merely tolerant of the Christian merchants passing through its ports became, under its own king, a Christian kingdom, in fact. To the people living through it, this must have looked like a sudden transformation. A bishop arrives, a king converts, a nation follows. I imagine there was wonder in it. Maybe some fear, too, the way any real change unsettles the people standing closest to it. But I was there long enough to see what they couldn't. This wasn't sudden at all. This was a decade of unglamorous tutoring finally showing its shape in daylight. And it mattered beyond Axum's own borders. When the Byzantine emperor himself tried to have Frumentius replaced, writing directly to Azana, pressing him to swap his old tutor for a bishop more to imperial liking, Azana refused. Think about what that refusal actually was. Not just theological loyalty. A grown king, with an empire's pressure bearing down on him, choosing to protect the man who'd taught him to think in the first place. That's not the behavior of a ruler humoring an old family servant. That's the behavior of a man who knows exactly what he owes and to whom. By the time Frumentius died, Axum had a church of its own, a bishop of its own, and because of choices made years earlier that no one thought to record at the time, a king who would not be talked out of any of it. Let me lay this out plainly, because I think the shape of it is too important to blur. Frumentius had a classical education because his family understood something simple. Education has value. Not sentimental value, practical, transferable, portable value. That's why they invested in it before he ever set foot on that ship. The king recognized that same value. He looked at a captive with nothing else to offer. No wealth, no name, no standing, and saw a mind that had already been shaped into something useful. So he put it to work. Secretary, treasurer, a role built entirely on what Frumentius knew, not on who he'd been born. Frumentius understood what he'd been given, and he used it exactly as it was meant to be used, not just for the king's ledgers, but eventually for something larger. He put his education in service of people around him, including the Christian merchants he helped worship openly for the first time. The queen saw that. She saw a man who didn't just possess knowledge, but who used it responsibly, in the open, for other people's benefit. And when her husband died and her son was too young to rule, that's exactly why she asked Frumentius to tutor the prince. Not because he was safe, because he was proven. That tutelage shaped how Izana ruled. Every choice a king makes as an adult is built on what he was taught as a child, and Izana had been taught for years by a man who believed knowledge was meant to be put to use for others, not hoarded. And then the relationship between the tutor and his student didn't end when the lessons did. It became the relationship between a new bishop and a new king, and that relationship is what transformed a kingdom. Not a sermon, not a decree. A grown man trusting the judgment of the person who'd raised him. Follow that chain all the way back, and here is what I want you to see clearly. Education is not a private possession. It is the mechanism of social transformation itself. A family valued it. A king recognized it. A tutor used it rightly. A student became who he was taught to be, and a kingdom changed because of it. So let me ask you something and take your time with it. I'm not going anywhere. What were you given once by someone who couldn't have known where you'd end up carrying it? A lesson, a skill, a way of seeing something that someone else took the time to teach you patiently, maybe without either of you realizing how much it would end up mattering. And here's the harder question, the one I really want to leave with you. Who are you quietly teaching right now? Not in a classroom, necessarily, not with a title, just in the ordinary work of showing someone, a child, a friend, someone younger and watching more closely than you think, what you know, and trusting them to carry it further than you can. You don't have to build a church. You don't have to raise a king. Most of us won't. But every single one of us has something worth handing forward and someone nearby who could use it. I wonder who that is for you. I wonder what you're already giving them without calling it anything at all. Before I go, I want to tell you a little about who's waiting for you next time. His name was Theodore Metachites, and he lived centuries after Frumentius in a Byzantine world that could feel, if you were paying attention, and he was like it might not last much longer. So he did something remarkable with the time he had. He filled a church with mosaics so beautiful they still stop people's breath today. And he filled a library with manuscripts, gathering and preserving texts as though he somehow knew an empire's ending wouldn't have to mean a civilization's ending, too. Not if enough was written down and kept safe first. I think you'll see the thread. I always do. Today, though, I keep thinking about a young man who lost everything on a Red Sea morning. His teacher, his crew, the whole future he thought he was sailing toward, and who discovered that the one thing no raider could take from him was also the one thing worth giving away completely. Frumentius didn't hoard what he knew. He spent it, patiently, on a child who grew up to reshape a kingdom because of it. That's the tapestry, my friend. Look closely enough, and you'll find it's held together by threads exactly like that one. Quiet, unglamorous, and stronger than anyone expected. This podcast is sponsored by Adulis Assurance Co., Red Sea Passage Insurance, Murky Waters, Protected Margins. Much love, I am Harmonia. Oh, one more thing before we go. I have a small favor to ask. If you enjoyed our time together, if this story stirred something in you, please take a moment to give History's Arrow a 5-star rating. It helps others find their way to these echoes of the past. And if you haven't already, be sure to subscribe so you don't miss the next step on our journey through time. Better yet, share this episode with a friend, a fellow traveler, someone who still believes that history matters. Until next time, keep your heart open to the past and your eyes on the arrow. This podcast sails out to you from Red Buoy Media, LLC. The stories we share are licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share Alike 4.0 International. That means you can pass them along, remix them, and even argue with them. Just give us credit, don't try to sell them, and share responsibly. Thanks for listening, friend. Until our next adventure.